Hi, you're listening to Chicago Magazine Chefs on the Grill.
4, 3, 2.
One more time.
Hi, I'm Mike Nagert, and welcome back for another Chefs on the Grill podcast. Chefs on the Grill is a collaboration between Hungry Magazine and Chicago Magazine. You can find all of our interviews with Chicago food personalities at www.chicagomag.com or www.hungrymag.com. Chicago's always been dubbed a meat and potatoes town, but that's really no longer the case. And to prove it, this month I caught up with Chicago's top retail fishmongers, Dirk Fusick and Bill Dugan, to talk about the state of seafood in Chicago. First up is Dirk Fusick. Dirk's been in the fish business for over 30 years, and he's been everything from a counter guy to a wholesaler to most recently sole owner of Dirk's Fish Shop up on Clybourne in the Lincoln Park neighborhood.
The thing I was thinking about, I know you've been in the business like 33 years.
Yeah, something like that, yeah, going 33 next year, so.
I wonder what, you know, the young Dirk coming out of high school going into the fish business, what you were thinking then.
I wasn't thinking about going into the fish business.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually replaced a friend of mine who was working for Burhoff's in their first retail store up in Wilmette, and he was, you know, he needed somebody to cover him on vacation, so I went and covered him on vacation, and, you know, kind of from there, you know, getting into it. I always liked fishing and, you know, fish stuff and eating fish, so it was always kind of, that part was good, and then, you know, dealing with people's kind of fun also, and got into that, and I was thinking of being a chef. I was in the Culinary Institute with another buddy of mine, and he ended up going, and I ended up staying, just because there's enough stuff going on in this biz that, you know, kept me interested, you know, cooking and, you know, talking with customers and things like that, and it just, you know, one thing led to another, and then I got into wholesale and did wholesale sales with the restaurants and, you know, that type of thing for like 5 or 6 years. That was okay. I mean, it was fun in its way too, but, you know, it wasn't my cup of tea as far as, you know, dealing with chefs and restaurants weren't as much fun as, you know, collecting money is always a bitch, you know, so, you know, that was the hard part about doing that. But,
right, those restaurants, man.
Yeah, you know, I mean, they get you, you know, you bust your butt, get in there, and then you, you know, take care of them as, you know, best you can, and, you know, you follow through and make sure you give them what they want. And, but then they still, you know, a lot of egotistical chefs, you know, coming out of, you know, school and stuff like that, think they know more than you after you've been doing this for 20 years. And, mm-hmm. you know, in the ideal world, you know, fish comes in 8-ounce skin, boneless mm-hmm. portions, you know, and there's no leftover waste. But, you know, that doesn't really exist in, except in cookbooks, you know. So,
yeah.
You know, you got to figure out what to do with the remainder of stuff. But, and then they don't pay you for like 60 days, you know,
right.
90 days and stuff like that. So you got to be a bank at the same time. So,
yeah.
So Burhoff's eventually went out of business. They got, you know, not bought out, but they got leveraged out of the ownership by one of the partners that got involved with it, and he just kind of put them out of business. So
mm-hmm.
I bought their retail store with a couple partners in 1990, actually, and so we ran that store in Wilmette for 1990 through 2002, and then in the meantime, we opened a store on North Avenue, you know, in 98 it was, actually, so, and that was, it was okay, but we had a fire the first, our lobster pond wiring caught on fire. We had a fire in the store, which, you know, shut us down for like 6 months, about 6 months after we opened, which is, you know, just a, you know, bad start, you know, so, bad start, you know, so, you know, we recovered from that, but North Avenue and Larrabee as well, wasn't it just kind of a weird location, you know,
yeah.
weird demographics and stuff like that. You get a wide variety of people in there, you know, upper class and,
sure.
you know, lower and et cetera. It's just, economics of it were all over the place, and it was too big of a space, and just, I don't know, just all kinds of things just didn't contribute to that being. One of the guys I always worked there said, we're on an Indian burial ground, that must be what it is, you know, so, this shit happened, you know, but then I just left my partners, you know,
yeah.
and stuff like that. You know, my ex-wife was one of my partners, so I split from her, and, you know, et cetera, and it was just easier to open up my own place at that point in time. We kind of pride ourselves in getting all kinds of stuff for people, too. I mean, we really carry a variety of things, like the king crab, for instance, that we looked at there. They're just not, you don't see those anywhere. You know,
yeah.
Nobody carries that stuff, and it's just, that's the kind of thing I like to, you know, I read all the time, you know, the trade magazine, things like that, and, you know, watch the Food Network, and, you know, kind of keep an eye on things that are going on, and you see something different and new, and you want to try it, or you want to, you know, go see if you can procure it, or people come from out of the country or from different areas in the country, and they want to try different things that you're just, you know, like live sea urchins, we get those in, or gooey duck clams,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, steamer clams, razor clams, and just all kinds of things that you don't see, you know, in your average market. So we get a lot of that stuff. So there's steamer clams with my lobsters this morning. And we get a lot of people in here, like East Coasters, you know, are one of my East Coasters are more stuck up than West Coasters, you know. So it's just, I don't know, we're more mellow on the West Coast. But they're so funny because they come in and they're real skeptical about buying fish in Chicago.
Sure.
You know, because they're, you know, off the East Coast and they're used to this, they're used to that, and everything fresh.
I think even Midwesterners are, you know, there's still sort of this idea of, can you get good seafood?
But Chicago's actually one of the best places in the country, I contend, that you can get seafood, because you got, you're in the middle of the country, you got O'Hare as a good hub, you got East Coast fish comes in, you got West Coast fish comes in, you got the Great Lakes stuff for the regional things, you're that equal distance to the Gulf of Mexico, and then there's so many restaurants in Chicago that demand good seafood that stuff comes in from all over the world. I mean, you get New Zealand stuff, Australian stuff, you get stuff out of you know, Canada, Europe, you know, Dover Soles, things like that. So it's really, and it turns over quick, you know. So there's a lot of good suppliers that have good connections that we get a ton of good stuff.
What would the typical process be from the time they pull it out and then it comes in the store? I mean, is that like 24 hours?
It's probably a little longer than that, but not much. But it's not more than a couple days max before we end up getting a cooked crab here out of Alaska. So that's pretty good. On an aside, I got a guy the other day. He called me a couple weeks ago for a sturgeon. A photographer needed a sturgeon for a shoot. Mm-hmm. And he wanted a small one, and all that was around at that time was big ones. So I left him a message as to what was around. And then I kind of forgot about it. So he called me Tuesday and says, oh, I'm just checking to see if my sturgeon's coming in today. And I go, well, Benny, you know, it's like, you know, I left your message about what I had available and what we could do, and you never called me back, you know, so I didn't really pursue it from there. So he said, oh, God, I got to have one tomorrow for my photo shoot, you know, and it's like, all right, start searching around. So I called one of my suppliers. It was too early to talk to anybody in the West Coast, but in the end, we ended up talking to one of the farms out west. Got him a sturgeon, like an 8-pound sturgeon, had him FedEx it to him yesterday is when it came to him, so, and then the guys called me here yesterday, because I was off yesterday, and they said, well, the guy got his sturgeon, and he took his pictures, and it came back to life. I said, well, I told him it would probably, because they're kind of, you know, it's like a shark or a sturgeon is a, you know, a prehistoric critter that's, you know, kind of primitive, and it's durable, and I said, that's coming right out of a fresh tank, and it's going right into a box, and it's kept cold. I mean, it's certainly possible that you could throw it back in water, and it would, you know, come back to life, you know? So he ended up bringing it here yesterday and got filleted, you know, nice. Just because it was that fresh that it was, you know, literally, you know, from the tank to him in less than 24 hours, you know, still wiggling.
Make a good photo shoot. It's a lively subject.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Gotta tell it to move a little.
Exactly, exactly. So it's got that good gleam to it. So, you know, things like that. Stuff gets here pretty quick, actually. But also, fish is more durable than people think. If it's handled right, you know, like, you know, salmon is the same way as a crab. It's taken out of the tanks, they're iced up, processed, boom, sent out. We get it within like 2 days of coming out of the water, and then it's probably good as a whole fish for probably another 4 or 5 days before you cut it, and probably from there you get another 2 days out of from there. We don't keep ours that long, but that's just the possibility of getting it that way. The fish that we get here, I always contend to people, is better than the fish that you get at a lot of restaurants, because at a restaurant, you know, it's a great restaurants and they serve perfectly good food, but the fish that you get on your plate is, you know, marinated, cooked, garnished, and you never see it au naturel, whereas the fish you're coming in here buying a piece of fish of, it's got to be like primo, because the piece of fish you're going to get here is, you know, you got to take it home, look at it, you may keep it for 2 days, and it's still going to be good, you know, as it was 2 days. You know, from now. So it's that's why it's important to have, you know, really, you know, good top
quality
stuff.
Although I'm still like one of those people who's like, even when I buy here, I'm like, I cook it that day. You know,
that's what we push. I mean, people come in here and they want to freeze this stuff, and it's like, eh. You know, if you live in, you know, Naperville or Indiana, we get a lot of people, you know, coming from out of town and stuff and passing through, and or coming here specifically even. But I try to encourage, you know, the locals not to, what's the point?
You know? Yeah, if you live down the street, you're their refrigerator.
Yeah, I mean, well, we get in every day. Why would you want to, you know, freeze salmon, you know, because the only salmon that we carry frozen is sockeye salmon that we get on Lummi Island, Washington, because it's a wild fish. They do a really, it's a specifically caught fish in a certain way that's, you know, caught and harvested and frozen the same day, kind of like the crab, actually. And it's a wild fish, and that's the only frozen fish I really carry, because I, you know, again, if we got to freeze it, what's the point?
Right.
You know, for me, it's all this. It's all about fresh. That's what we're here for, is really, you know, pushing fresh fish. So,
how have consumers changed in the 30 years that you've been in the business? I mean, my guess would be that people now might be more educated or more interested. But I don't know. And again, you know, people have become, like you said, they want the 8-ounce filet package, you know, whereas maybe 30 years ago people were a little more comfortable with the full fish because they were closer to their European descent.
Right.
I don't know.
Well, it's like, you know, things change, you know, everything's cyclic and things like that. I mean, you get into that and you get into the, you know, prepackaged food and everything being portioned and things like that. And again, that's how they push it at supermarkets. If you go to, you know, a lot of places, you find them pre-wrapped, ready to go. But I think we find that we get a lot more people, I mean, fish is health food. I mean, fish is really healthy for you in so many ways. And I think more people are getting, you know, health conscious in the last probably 10 or 15 years, more so than before. Of course, you get a lot of adverse media that, you know, I don't agree with on a lot of things they say, because a lot of things that they say have a grain of truth, but they, you know, just elaborate on the bad parts of it, and then they don't bother telling you the good parts, because that would take away from the bad, you know?
I noticed on your website you had the thing about, there was a study from Harvard.
That just came out. Yeah, that one in there.
You know, the adverse effects are much more outweighed by the health benefits.
Well, it's like 900-to-1 health benefits on a piece of salmon, you know? Mm-hmm. So you have 900 plus and 1 minus. So, I mean, what's the proportion of that? That's just, it's just ridiculous. And even the FDA numbers that they use for like the mercury counts and stuff like that are based on a study that's kind of skewed, because that study takes place in the Faroe Islands, and all the Faroe Islanders eat whale meat like every day, and whale meat is high in PCBs and mercury. And
is that hold true though for like local fish, like Lake Michigan, where you have more industrialization?
Well, you have to, if you're a recreational fisherman, there's what I suggest is you go every year when I buy my license, you pick up a, like State of Illinois puts out a brochure, and it tells you about where to go fishing, local rules and regulations, and there's a couple pages on there about health. And there's certain places, right, that you probably don't want to eat fish out of. Waukegan Harbor was one of them because they put a lot of stuff in there. They have restrictions on, or suggested restrictions on eating fish out of the lake, certain fish, you know, certain sizes that have been out there. But generally speaking, small fish who haven't been around for long tend to have, you know, low mercury counts. And, you know.
What about overfishing? You know, I've read stuff about, again, you know, maybe, and I don't know.
All the fish should be gone by 2048?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
like
the latest one.
all these guys are, like, going out farther and farther to get their catches because there's just...
Well, a lot of it is true. I mean, you know, the ocean was thought to be an endless source of, you know, product in all sorts. But it's with our technology these days, like drift netting, which they banned in a lot of places. You know, you go out and put out miles and miles of nets, and then you come back after them, and you catch whatever. They're very indiscriminate, and they would catch, you know, dolphins, turtles, you know, things that you weren't looking for. And then once they're in the net and dead, then what do you do with it? You throw them away. So that was a big waste there. But that's pretty much outlawed now. There's not many countries that do that. There's always a few rogue countries like, you know, like Spain and things like that is one that always gets in other people's territories and does stuff that, you know, they shouldn't be doing so much or whatever. They cheat a little bit. And they don't take into consideration farming. You know, farming produces like 25% of the fish in the world.
Yeah, I was going to ask you
about
that.
And that's a good thing, too. Though farming has got its bad raps for different things, you know, salmon farming, things like that, about supposed to be sea lice. You hear about them over... you know, populate or polluting, you know, areas and things like that, overfeeding. You hear about, you know, chemicals in the fish. I mean, a lot of those things have some grain of truth to them, but they're not, they're all things that are being addressed. You as a salmon farmer, it's a multi-million dollar business. I mean, you don't decide to go open up a salmon farm tomorrow and just do it. You know, you have to have resources to do it. They do environmental impact studies on where you can put it. You'll have to get, you know, permission from Canada or U.S. if you want to open up a fish farm. You know, they don't just let you do it. A lot of the farms these days are much more regulated. They're much more on top of how they produce it and what goes into the fish and things like that, because there is a lot of
focus on farm-raised product.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of farm-raised product. I think if you didn't have farm-raised product, just think of how much more pressure there would be on wild stocks. Mm-hmm. You know, I always tease people, oh, it's farm-raised. You know, it's, I go, then what's wrong with that? You know, I mean, the cows eat, the pigs eat, the chickens eat, everything else is farm-raised. What's wrong with farm-raised fish? And who the hell knows where the wild fish have been? You know, so, you know, they could have swam through that oil slick or something like that, you know? wild fish, like salmon in particular, have a bigger flavor. I mean, that's one of the main things, the main differences, I think. They're leaner, which some people like, but if you want omega-3s, which people are looking for health, then farm salmon, there's been studies that show farm salmon has higher contents of omega-3s than wild fish.
Mm-hmm. What do you look for in a supplier or a vendor to you? You know, like somebody, you know, how do you, what's important to you in choosing somebody to work with?
Well, number one, I again, being in the business a long time, I know a lot of people and I've gone through a lot of different suppliers. And basically, I have like really three main suppliers that take care of me, and I've known them for years. And you have to train your supplier to what you want. So if you have certain things that you're looking for, quality, et cetera, then you have to let them know that's what you want. And you can explain that to them. Part of it, though, is when it comes in, I order daily, because that way you can just order small amounts. You get it in every day. And by having a couple different suppliers, as good as they may be, you know, if you get something that's not up to your standards, then you just send it back and they can recoup.
How is the industry set up? I mean, are there sort of like a few big brokers that are really,
You can do, in this fishing industry is a weird industry. It's not like cow farms and pig farms and chicken farms that are real big industrial places. I mean, you can talk to individual fishermen. If you were a fisherman and you had a steady supply of something, I mean, you can get on the phone, you can call anybody you want. And then with shipping these days, I mean, you can pack it up. You know, you do a good job, you handle your fish nice, you get it to the airport and send it up. I mean, I could buy from an individual, or you as an individual fisherman could sell to really anybody you want. But my Dungeness crab come from a guy in Bellingham, Washington. You know, he fishes the crab. You know, he calls me on the phone, and, you know, I hear his motor running on the boat and the birds in the background, and he's heading out to pick up his pots, you know. And he's, what are you looking for this week? I said, 50 pounds. And, you know, he hasn't even caught them yet. And then they'll be here, like, you know, the next day or a day later after he comes back in.
Yeah. So I wonder about, like, Jewel and Dominic's, that kind of thing. You know, you said there's no real, like, big commercial poultry industry equivalent or whatever. What are you getting there that, you know, because, I mean, just using my intuition and like eating stuff from your place and then, you know, eating stuff from there, there's a clear difference, you know,
oh, yeah,
in case. And what are they doing? What is their supply chain like?
Well, like salmon, for instance, because that's a popular fish everywhere. And that's Atlantic salmon's farm raised in various places in the world. The stuff we get's out of Maine or Canada. There's a lot of farms in Chile also. And what a lot of the supermarkets get, Chilean fish is cheaper. So, and it tends to be, I don't know, it just doesn't have quite the same flavor, even though you can do whatever you want on a salmon farm. You can flavor them, color them, whatever, you know, and produce whatever you want, the end result you want. But Chilean fish for the supermarkets, for instance, is processed usually in Chile. So when you order fillets, pin bone out, portioned, whatever, you can order anything you want, you know, from a salmon. They'll make it any way you want. But that stuff's processed in Chile. And then even though transportation is quick, it still has a chain of, you know, it's got a lot of it flies into Florida, and then from Florida it flies up to Chicago. A lot of supermarkets carry that fish because it's a less expensive fish. You can, and again, I just don't like it as much as the Maine stuff. And I kind of like buying, you know, American product. You figure it's coming from a closer area, helps, you know, the country and economy, etc. But we buy whole fish and cut it as we go. And again, that makes the huge difference on everything, I think. I mean, when you get a whole fish in, comes in the back door, you look at it, you can see that it's a good fish. You know, the eyes are clear, the gills will be red, it'll have a nice slime on it, it'll be firm to touch. When you buy fillets, we do buy some fillets, and you got to look at those, and they're usually pretty good. But a fillet, really, you don't exactly know when it was processed. So that's the thing that I think is the difference between supermarkets. Also, it's service. I mean, because here you come in and you get a whole fish, we'll cut it. You want the middle piece, you want the end piece, you want a sushi cut, you want a cut for sashimi, you know, we'll do all that from that whole fish. So whereas you go to the supermarket, you know, your 8-ounce fillets are cut in a package already, you're not going to get sashimi cut at Jewel because they're not going to have the capability to do it, nor do they have the right piece of salmon to do that either. So, I mean, that's going to be a big part of it there.
Yeah, you've been doing salads, a lot of cooking classes too.
Yeah,
right?
We just started doing, sushi's always been a popular class. We do a sushi class almost every month, except for the summer months. And we just did a Mediterranean cooking class this week that we had 16 people. That was great. And next year we're going to do two. We're going to be doing two a month here. And just doing right in the store. And people really, you know, people enjoy it. And it's kind of a casual. It's, you know, we're teaching you. We got great recipes. My wife's an awesome cook, and she comes up with great recipes. We ate all the recipes we did on a Tuesday, Saturday night at home. You know,
yeah,
you know,
just
was guinea pigging us, you know, and trying this and that. We tweaked a little from there, and then we cook them at the classes, and they're original, you know, recipes, and they're really good, and they're all easy, because that's one thing we're trying to promote too. Is fish is the original fast food. I mean, it takes, you know, 10 minutes to cook a piece of fish, and a good piece of fish doesn't need much prep to it. One of our, you know, fresh marinades, throw it on there for, you know, a half hour, throw it in the oven for 10 minutes, boom, you're done. And it's really, it'll be some of the best fish you ever eat.
And you carry caviar
too. Oh, yeah, sure, yeah, pretty much everything. We don't carry imported caviar anymore.
Yeah,
there's a ban in September to bring imported in, which confuses me a little bit, because I was looking on the internet the other day, and a lot of companies here in the States still have beluga caviar. But you can get, like, 2 kilo tins of beluga, for instance, they're good for like 2 years mm-hmm. if you keep them cold and you have to rotate them and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So I'm guessing that a lot of these companies that still have beluga for sale have bought it before, you know, the ban on it in September. But now that was September of last year, really. So now you're talking it's a year old, the stuff right. you got now. So at best, next year, if you start seeing that stuff offered by, you know, U.S. companies, then it's, you know, either... Yeah. You know, it's either illegal, you know, or it's going to be really old, yeah. which is not what you want.
Has there been a demand that surprised you? Like, people just started loving something? That
well,
you...
king crab, again, it's one of those things in the last 3 years is the time we've started carrying king crab. And the first year we had it, people bought it and liked it, and it was, and they liked it a lot. Each year, you get more people, new people to try it because you hear more about it and it gets more promotion. I mean, this year I heard more about it. There's an article in the Tribune, you know, a couple of weeks ago about king salmon or about the king crab. And just in general, things like that start getting more press and then more people hear about it and they come in and try it and there's nothing like it. I mean, it's really good.
I personally like better than lobster.
Oh,
I think it's like it's the fillet of the sea or whatever you want to call it.
Oh, yeah, it's the best thing of the sea. I mean, people tow lobster, but really the crab is just so much better than lobster, I think. And you get this stuff, people come in and they say, oh, how about some king crab? Want to try a taste? And they say, eh, you know, I don't like king crab all that much. You can try a taste, please. Just they say, all right. So they taste it, and the first words, I mean, 90% of the people go, oh, my God.
Yeah.
And it's just that good that it's so sweet and succulent. Did you cook this in butter? You know, it's how it tastes.
Yeah.
It doesn't need anything, you know, so... Yeah.
I asked Dirk if there were any places that did seafood exceptionally well in Chicago.
Like Japanese is a great place to go. I mean, they got really good sushi there. The rest of the food is good, too. They have a good ambiance. You know, they have a good lounge downstairs on the river, which is kind of fun. What are the good places? We go to Weber Grill's actually not bad. It's for me, it's, you know, got the beef end of it,
right,
you know.
Right.
And they got some pretty good stuff over there fish-wise and things of that sort. But I got to admit, it's people ask me about, you know, what's your favorite fish restaurant? And I got to tell them it's, you know, it's our house in Skokie, you know.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
I got the best choices there, so. But, and I tell a lot of people also that.
Maybe we should open up one of those supper clubs.
Exactly, yeah. Something like that. I don't know if I want to work that late, you know. That's the downside with restaurants. But
Bill Dugan's doing the Well Fleet now.
Right, exactly. But you know what? It's like a lot of people can make equivalent meals at home. That's one of the things we try to tell people here, too. I mean, you can, without spending the money going out to a restaurant, you can take a piece of good fish and, you know, we can give you a recipe. We got recipes online. You can come in here. I'll never let you leave without telling you how to cook your fish and giving an idea. And then people come back because people are scared of fish. And for whatever reason, I know how to cook. I'm a great cook. I know how to do Italian. I know how to do this. I know how to do that. I can't cook fish. And, well, why can't you cook fish? Because they're scared of fish. And, you know, fish isn't cheap as it used to be. And, you know, so you can spend, you know, $25 a pound on Chilean bass. And if you ruin it, then you're less apt to want to go back and spend the $25 again and, you know, try again. You know, but if you take that same piece of fish home with a miso marinade and you bake it broiled or throw it on the grill and it comes out great, then, you know, you're like, oh, cool. And it gives you more confidence. And once with a little more confidence, then you're willing to try other things and branch out.
So a question I always ask chefs is, you know, you're on death row and you know it's going to be your last meal. What would your last meal be if you knew? Or, you know, maybe what would your last fish be? What would your last fish feast be?
Gosh, I don't know. I'd have to, if I could just have one thing, I might have to go back to that king crab again.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, getting a big old king crab and just, you know, eating that would be pretty damn good. So
yeah.
We also have a Kona Gold Kempachi out of Hawaii. It's a farm-raised yellowtail that we've just been getting for the last few weeks, and it's really phenomenal, too. I mean, that fish just sliced, you know, we get it whole, we cut it, and then we slice it off, and it's really, really good. So if I was going to eat a fish, that might be my last fish there, you know, sliced, you know, thin, but I don't know, I'd have to, if I had one choice, I'd probably have to go with that king crab, so.
So who would win in a steel cage match, you or the fish guy, Bill Dugan?
Oh, I don't know, gosh, he does his own thing, and, you know, he does a lot of wholesale and things like that, and he's got a good retail, but, you know, I think we take it a step farther than him for service and things like that. I mean, as far as people coming in here, all of my guys are pretty experienced, we're very friendly, I'm, you know, really promote the fact that you want to, you know, be nice to people, help them out, you know, guide them, and that's really where we, you know, stand out. I mean, every fish we buy for the retail customer is for the retail customer. I mean, you know, Bill does his wholesale thing, and I think some of his wholesale stuff trickles down to retail, which is fine, you know, if it's good, but, you know, he does his $10 Thursdays, you know, and stuff like that. Chilean bass for $10 a pound is less than I pay for it, so I don't know why, you know.
Yeah.
I'd sell it for $10 a pound, personally, you know. So, but, you know, like I said, everybody does their own thing, and, you know, and he's been around for a while, so he's successful.
What are some of the oddest requests you've had for seafood products?
Well, that fresh sturgeon, I told you about that story about getting that thing that quick was kind of an interesting one. Sea urchins, sea cucumbers, razor clams. But, you know, all those are procurable. One I haven't really been able to come up with is barnacles. You know, if you go to Spain, for instance, barnacles are a popular thing there that you can get. And barnacles here, there's not a big market for them. There are limited season for them. There's limited harvest for them. And it's such a small fishery that it almost never makes it here.
What
generally get?
What makes fish seasonal? Is it like when they're spawning and things like that? Like, because I wondered about that. You know, it's like, you know, with growing seasons, well, you know, that's a climate thing. And, you know, I was curious about fish seasonality. I didn't really.
Well, fish seasonality, I mean, farming kind of takes some of that away. It's the same with the vegetables. You know, I mean, you get asparagus in January. It just comes from someplace else in the world.
Sure.
Same with a lot of the fish farming. I mean, it makes it available year-round for certain products. But like the Great Lakes, for instance, if you look at the Great Lakes fishery, you know, weather plays a huge factor, obviously. I mean, it's actually kind of funny because you can actually get fish in January because when the lakes totally freeze, you can fish through the ice, and they commercially fish through the ice. But it's that in-between time, you know, when the ice is forming and things like that, you put out your nets and the ice takes your nets away and ruins your nets or, you know, puts them under, you can't get stuff. And sometimes in the really hot weather, again, in the Great Lakes, it drives fish deeper down, and then you don't get pike in, say, August, you know, sometimes. But and another big one is salmon, of course, you know, because salmon, Alaskan salmon, wild salmon is a seasonal thing. Sockeye is the big thing. And Memorial Day, when you get that first sockeye run, that stuff was $40 a pound this year. You know, the initial week that it opened up, you know, drops down to 25 pretty fast. But because it's got such a big hype for it at the beginning of the season, soft shell crabs, same thing, stone crab. I mean, all those things are based on weather, you know. So when the crabs shed the soft shells out of the Chesapeake, it's like the full moon of May is kind of a general broad guideline for when they shed, but the water's warm enough at that time, and that full moon stimulates that huge first influx of crabs that have been sitting all winter long cold, you know, kind of waiting to pop out of their old shell into the new shell. And so that's a big factor. And then you got the salmon, the halibut's kind of the same thing. That's based on quotas. So it's some of, you know, some quotas, but a lot of it's weather, you know, so, and it depends where things come from in the world, so.
Had the Gulf Coast, the Katrina thing, did that impact?
It did a lot of fishermen, yeah. I mean, big on stone crabs because they had, before Katrina and Wilma came, there was like 1.5 million crab pots licensed out to Florida. And after those two hurricanes passed, I think they only had like 700,000 left. So they lost more than half of their traps. And then they lost infrastructure, boats, you know, a lot of fishermen lost a lot of stuff there. So, and there's no really recovery for those guys because they don't have, like, there's the government, you know, subsidizes and helps out disaster victims of, like, you know, when it frosts in Florida and the frost hits the orange trees and stuff like that, they get recompensed by the government because there's a program in place for that. When fishermen get, you know, hit by the hurricane, they lose their boats and things.
There's no
disaster fund for them. They're working on that now, but, you know, so that plays a big factor, you know, obviously.
Does it change the ecology of the fish or the quality of the fish?
Well, you know, it's like nature's pretty, you know, bounces back well, you know. I mean, there's a lot of stone crabs down there this year, you know, but there's less people fishing for them, so that's, you know, good for the stone crabs. But stone crab varies according to if it's windy, they move around more when it's windy because on the top of the water, it's not as clear and it kind of gives them more sense of security, so they're out and about more. On clear days when it's beautiful weather that you think would be a great day to go fishing, that's not the best day to go stone crabbing because they're kind of tucked in their nooks and crannies and they don't want to come out. And this year I heard actually the octopus, they eat stone crab. And the octopus population, you know, everything's cyclic up and down. So in a big year for octopus, it's going to be a bad year for stone crab because they're, you know, going to be eating, you know. And then the octopus, like, next year come around, and since the previous year's octopus ate a lot of stone crab, there's less stone crab eat, so that next group of octopus aren't going to get as much, so then they kind of fizzle down, and then the stone crab will go up again. So, you know, things are cyclic like that, up and down on a lot of fish. Great Lakes has a lot of cycles on things like that, too.
What's your vision for the future of Dirks? Is there anything you haven't done that you really want to do?
Oh, tons of things, you know. So, sure, yeah. No, we'd like to, we've only been here like 3.5 years now, so we've got a pretty good reputation and a lot of things going now. So I want to tap into more The more online stuff, I mean, get people to, you know, try to maybe do an online store even. We've talked about delivery, but we ain't doing it yet, you know, so that's an option. Try to do more classes, you know, educate people more as part of it. We'd like to actually do more stuff. We always are interested in the Food Network and trying to, you know, kind of go into a show in Miami. This is February, and, you know, just kind of push, you know, ourselves and try to send stuff out to the media and, you know, to, you know, hit Oprah or, you know, whatever. Just, you know, see if we can get some more, you know, PR that way. And kind of, it'd be fun that my wife and I talk about having a show.
That'd
you know,
be awesome.
It'd be good. Like, you know, because there's no really husband and wife show out there per se. And again, it's kind of just easy down home cooking. I mean, all this would be easy stuff.
There's no fish show.
That's the other thing. It's like you go out there and look. I mean, you know, Iron Chef does, you know, a tuna or something like that. But again, you know, people, what they do in the Iron Chef is not what you're doing at home. You know, I mean, that's the extreme, you know, professional chefs doing a lot of stuff.
I always make five courses in the
night. Oh, don't you though? Yeah, exactly.
I don't know
well,
about you.
Well, my wife is like, we did our class, and I said, this is, my wife's going to show you how to you blow Rachel Ray away. I mean, she can whip up, you know, this, we did five dishes in an hour and a half, you know, and stuff like that, and they were all great and easy. But that's the thing. It's fish is, you know, we want to promote that fish is easy. So that's one of the things we, you know, down the road like to, you know, maybe even branch out into at some point. It would be kind of cool to have a little, you know, Dirk's Fish on the Food Network, and then, you know, just educate people and, you know, just, you know, spread it out more. So that's kind of what we're doing. In the meantime, we'll give you fresh fish every day.
Awesome.
Good stuff.
Thanks a lot.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Appreciate you.
My pleasure. So
now we turn our attention to the fish guy, Bill Dugan. While Dirk Fusick holds down the Lincoln Park area, Dugan's store is located up the road in Old Irving Park. When Dugan moved here in 1990, he recognized that Chicagoans had their guys. Hot dog guys, transmission guys, oil guys. So when he opened his retail outlet in 1996, he decided he wanted to be the fish guy. Like Fusick, Dugan started in the fish business over 30 years ago when he was 17.
I got out of high school a year early, and my dad was pissed off that I wasn't going to college. And I told him I would, and I was back visiting. But it was in the winter, and I took one of my nieces and nephews out of school, just drove down the Cape, because they used to camp there out in Wellfleet. You know, we just took a drive. We drove down to Provincetown. It was deserted, and we went on a fisherman's wharf, and there was a packing house open. It was a pretty miserable day, as I remember, and you know, we kind of just wanted to get in out of the cold. And we were walking around, and some guy asked what was up. We were just, you know, what do you got going on here? And I just started talking to the guy, and he was, I think, offhandedly and almost jokingly, he said, you know, well, if you can sell, I'll tell you what, if you could sell some bluefin tuna in the summer for me out there in California, you know, that'd be great. And because my uncle, my godfather, had, and I guess this is how it got brought up, he had been an executive at Pan Am and at Logan Airport in Boston. When he retired, they lived in Marblehead, and then he retired, they moved up to Maine. So he had bought, with some Korean veteran buddies, some 747s from Flying Tigers, and started flying lobsters over to the Far East, and then, you know, probably carrying back widgets, who knows. So I was telling the guy this, and he was like, wow, you know, so that was, no one had thought about that. So I was like, well, you know, I knew Willie, this guy who owned Berkeley Bowl, Japanese guy, and my dad had turned us all on to sushi previously that year. And so I thought, well, you know, I'll ask. And yeah, I got all the lowdown. He said, these things are big mothers. And, you know, sure, so-and-so can build the box. And we build the box, line it with styrofoam, get some big tarps so that it doesn't leak. And, you know, because those are the things that my uncle said they're really concerned with, because it could damage the inside of the plane, da-da-da. And as it turned out, they were a little bigger than coffins, and you know, that's how people ship deceased around. So they even had rates for it, you know. And we got the same rates as deceased people. But, you know, I called the guy, I think it was sometime around May, and said, you know, I've got some people interested. He was happy to hear from me, and I said, ship one out. I picked the thing up. I rented a borrowed a friend's van. I drove it over to Berkeley. This guy shit his pants when he saw this tuna. I mean, it was like almost 800 pounds. And I was paying 75 cents a pound, and the freight at the time was probably 25, 30 cents. And I thought I was being a total pirate asking $4. And he bought it right off the bat, said he wanted two more as soon as I could get them.
Pretty soon Dugan was selling thousands of pounds of tuna, and he figured he'd be doing this for a while, but competition and a bad fishing season made the next year a tough haul. So Dugan discovered an untapped supply of Jonah crab and started selling 50-pound orders to Trader Vic's weekly. On one of his delivery runs, he discovered Spanger's, which was one of the largest restaurants in the country, and it was seafood-driven. Dugan made an unexpected score, but he also got a taste of the problems that come with success.
So, everything worked out. Showed up on time, drove it over to him. He had a couple of his guys help me unload it. He spot-checked it, was sitting there eating it, had a chef come out. They mumbled a few things to one another. He goes, okay, we'll take 3,000 pounds for next Thursday, you know, next week. And I'm like, oh, my God. And here's my first glimpse of greed. My friends, they were selling 10 pounds of this stuff a week if they were lucky. And they said they were paying what I knew what they were paying. They were making a buck on every pound, you know. It was like all of a sudden now they're making $2,000-$3,000 a week for doing nothing. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't enough, right? They wanted in on it. That's really what prompted me to just start my own thing. I was like, you know, all right, screw it.
Dugan found independent sources and started working California restaurants on his own. He hooked up with the Kennedys' former White House chef, Rene Verdun, who was running a restaurant in California. This is where Dugan experienced one of many of his transformative food experiences.
And the guy knew how to cook. And he used to always say, when are you going to come in? It's like, I had this girlfriend for years and years. She was considerably older, and she was Chinese and very shy. Where do you go to eat? You know, well, I would go to, you know, Asia Gardens and go for dim sum on Sunday and stuff. So he insisted that I bring her in one day. When he said, you got to come in. Come in tomorrow night, Friday. Pretty big thing. I mean, I was still learning about cuisine. Growing up, food held no interest in me at all, you know. And I didn't like hardly any of it. Peanut butter and jelly, a burger, you know.
Yeah, pizza.
I mean, mustard was foreign to me, you know what I mean? Lettuce. I hated vegetables. So we went in there, and I'll tell you, man, he treated us like he rolled out the red carpet. And brought us over to Julia Childs and her husband Paul were in there eating. He never mentioned that, and the whole deal was we were joining them. And so he sat us with them. Of course, I used to like watching her and the Graham Kerr. For some reason, I don't know, I just liked watching the cooking show, even though I wasn't interested in food.
Dugan moved to Napa Valley, and he hooked up with chefs at Domaine Chandon, where he was blazing a trail selling some of the first foie gras in the United States.
Not only, he was floored with the stuff, and there was other stuff I brought him, you know. I met through another uncle, the first guy to do foie gras in this country. He was a neighbor of one of my uncles out on Long Island. He had a company called Amazon Coffee and Tea. He made his money there, and he started fooling around with ducks, you know, doing Long Island duckling. And then he learned about the foie gras thing. And so I was the first guy to do foie gras. And I was selling it to cats like him, man. He'd be buying 50, 60, 100 loaves a week.
I mean, so was this Sonoma?
No, this was being done in Long Island.
Oh, okay.
So none of those places had even...
So this is like pre-Hudson Valley, all that?
Oh, wait, yeah, this was like in 1979.
Okay.
Today, Dugan still sells foie gras at the Fish Guy Market, and he has some strong beliefs on the recent Chicago ban.
You know, the foie gras that I use, I know the farm in Quebec, I know how it's handled. I'm not trying to make some big statement about it, but, you know, I am saying, screw these aldermen. I mean, that is unconstitutional, for Christ's sakes. And it also broke interstate commerce laws. I don't know, attorney, but you can't do that. You know, and I mean, you know, get some guns off the street, start feeding kids some decent meals at their school lunch program, and teaching kids about nutrition so you don't have, you know, 160-pound 8-year-olds out there eating, you know. I mean, come on. We have some serious issues in this country.
What farm in Quebec do you use?
It's a small independent farm called La Champs de Lazé. And, you know, this guy tries to mimic what goes on in the Périgord so that when he'll give like 24 of these birds at a time to neighbors' kids as part of, you know, like to fill farm it up. So during the fattening process, they're hand fed. But even then, you know, those things are like little puppies. They're mimicking what happens in nature.
Mm-hmm.
Before they, you know, make their trek, they have to fatten up. It's just like the salmons, you know, coming upstream. They got a long ways to go.
Dugan continued to work on the edges, developing new purveyors and bringing cutting-edge fish to Napa and the rest of the United States.
But like the monkfish we did a big business with, then I went back and met these guys who were raising Belon oysters, started a lot of eastern shellfish, the PEI mussels, I was the first one to bring those things in. You know, I guess if I look back on what I've done and why I enjoyed it so much is, yeah, I was kind of a trailblazer. And I never set out to be that.
Dugan was an outdoors guy who loved the freewheeling Napa lifestyle. But as time passed, Napa became more commercialized, and Dugan headed to Chicago, where he established Superior Ocean Produce, a wholesale operation that sold to some of Chicago's best restaurants. Dugan started working with Charlie Trotter, and the two of them coined the names for some of today's popular fish.
I read that you coined the phrase diver scallops. Is that true?
Yeah, I've gotten creative with nomenclature over the years. Trophy trout, sturgeon bullets. I mean, you know, it's merchandising at the end of the day. Blueberry bass. These are things that they've just stuck over the years, and it's. But I always write on our signage where it's from, what it is. You know, if it's a nickname, you know, I have it in print. I don't want to mislead anybody. It's just like Peaky Toe Crab. That came from Charlie asking me, what do the guys up in Maine call it? And I said, they call it pick-a-toe, you know, because it's like the toe, pick the toe of the crab. And I said, that kind of sells. Sounds kind of toe cheesy to me or something, I don't know. And he laughed about it, and then next thing he's calling it Peaky Toe, you know. And I think he had a staff meeting and it was just a misspelling, you know. And then and now it's made it into the, you know, and this is how this stuff happens. Same with the diver scallops, you know.
Trotter has always been a good partner, but the restaurant industry changed. People were quitting their corporate jobs, going to culinary school, graduating with 2-year degrees. But some of the newly minted chefs were business people first and chefs second, unwilling to take a chance on unfamiliar products.
It always bugged me when a chef said, I don't like that. Your customers are going to appreciate the fact that you have found this new thing. You don't like sea urchin? How do you know you don't like sea urchin?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you've had the crap that's overly processed with alum in the sushi bars. I don't like that stuff either.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've ever popped open a live sea urchin and eaten that roe out of the shell, it's delicious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hardly has flavor. It's just like the sea. It's like you're eating the sea. And, you know, so it's like when people say, oh, I don't like that. you know, come on, man. That's like saying you don't like gay people and you're living in San Francisco. Why are you a chef?
Mm-hmm.
You know, granted, Alinea, I got people come in my retail store buy more fish in a day than he does sometimes. Now, I don't mean that disparagingly.
No.
I'm just saying, who knows what he's doing?
Right.
If I ask, he'll tell me. You know, but he's sometimes just using the, quite often just the essence of something, or, you know, he's, you know,
yeah.
Any restaurant of note in this city that's opened or is open since I moved here, I've dealt with them at one time or another.
Dugan shifted some of his attention to opening up the Fish Guy retail outlet in 1996. He wanted to replicate an old school spirit he witnessed while traveling.
That's how I've always liked to sell. My son's mom, you're over in Denver. She grew up in Denver. And be at her granny's house, man. I mean, the Fiskman would come over from the coast twice a week. And this van, I mean, the stuff they had was so fresh. I mean, I felt ashamed to be a fishmonger. I mean, honest to God. I mean, so she'd show up Santa Thursday, and then she would tell him what she would like on Tuesday. Could he find her some place? She wanted to make her son-in-law some place, or you know, whatever. And that's how it went. You know, it's like you wanted the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. And that's why I opened the store. That was the mentality around Napa. Or, you know, the wine country when I was growing up there.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of like the store better, you know,
mm-hmm.
because I get to talk to people about stuff. They're more curious, you know, and that just.
Yeah, I wondered about that. What's the flip side? What's the consumer side like? You know, you'd think of Chicago as still like a meat and potatoes town
yeah.
in some ways, but you know, how is that? You know, are you changing people's attitudes, you know, about fish? And
yeah, I mean, you have that opportunity one person at a time, you know? I mean, it continues to amaze me how far people come to come here to this store, you know? Like, I love the Kalina Market. I think that place, I love going in there, I think it's great. I like how they merchandise their stuff. I got a lot of inspiration from them. I still do. But it's a trip. And I realize that people may like my store and may have every intention of coming over, but you know, they got stuck in traffic. Now they're up at the Jewel doing their regular shopping or wherever they shop. And it's like, oh man, you know, I don't know if I'm going to make it on time, or I just don't feel like going over there. So here's some salmon, or here's some catfish. This looks decent. I'm just going to buy that here. And I understand that. I think I'm flattered that they've come out of their way to here, because let's face it, this is all I've got is fish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we try to do other things to help jumpstart a meal, because what I've always said is, I know lots of people who are very masterful cooks, but they're very intimidated by seafood. There's not an appreciation of the market like here as there is in Europe, you know?
Is the retail stuff the same kind of quality that you're selling to your restaurant accounts?
Yeah, absolutely. We cut the fish fresh every day, and you know, some fish is just simply fresher than others. So some fish we might cut on a Monday, Tuesday it still looks perfectly good, and even on Wednesday, you know, but that's an exception. Usually it's sold within a day. Some stuff can carry into the next day, no problem. We make that decision each morning. I got high standards, okay? So this is what I'm saying. Maybe those people took it home and cooked it and thought it was great,
mm-hmm.
but they wouldn't have enjoyed it nearly as much as if it was really nice and fresh. And I'm a big proponent of mariculture, so I believe in it, you know. And it's like farming practices, different husbandry. Some do better than others, much better than others. So the freshest fish we get in here are always mariculture product, you know.
So by mariculture, what some people would say is farm raised. Is that
yeah,
what you're
doing? Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of positives. There's a lot of safety issues there. You can control the quality so much better. Having said that, I still like wild sturgeon better. I still like wild caught fish anytime.
The quality of Dugan's fish might be high, but I also wondered about mercury concerns.
Well, I sent my hair samples in, and my son's hair samples to Greenpeace's website, $40 or something. And yeah, he was as low as I was, and he doesn't eat much fish. Mm-hmm. He's a kid. He eats pizza. But I couldn't have been on the lowest end of the scale, on a 1 to 10. 10 being maybe you should start considering your diet. But I was at the 1. And I'm eating all the things they're telling you not to eat. I didn't want to nyanya about it. I just wanted to be able to speak intelligently when a pregnant woman came in with and voiced her concerns. Rather than speculate, now I was able to say, look, this is what I did. There's a lot of information out there on the web. That's the beauty of it. But there's also a lot of misinformation. So I said, here's an opportunity where for $40-$50 you can send in some hair strands and find out exactly where you stand.
One of the ways Dugan gets such quality fish is that, like Dirk Fusick, he goes straight to the fishermen.
I've been out on these boats with these cats, and I'm telling you, I mean, they are can-do people. They're great readers of literature. And a lot of these people, look, they're reading, what Daniel Balut is charging for a scallop at his restaurant. He's getting $35 for a scallop, and I'm getting, 50 cents. What's happening here? How do I prevent this? How do I get more money?
Even with all the quality fish, running a small retail business is still tough, especially when Chicago's old patronage system works against you.
I mean, it's a dart in the ass having your own little business. There's a lot of downsides to it, particularly when you get into the retail. I mean, you can't go anywhere on holidays, We get. There's so much oversight to what we do. City, state, federal, fish, shellfish, fish and game. I mean, they spin your head. They mm-hmm. come in here, and you can't tell them to fuck off. You're busy. You got to stop what you're doing. They always come in on Friday. They're nice guys, but shit, they take up your whole day, and you cannot treat them with disdain. Because they can shut you down.
Sure.
And then they have to hand out a fine or two because now that's what the mayor's told them to do, right? And it's a racket. Oh, well, you've got pounds written on the clam tag instead of count. Well, that's how I sell it. That's how I inventory it. Oh, you're supposed to put count. Oh, it's no big deal. Well, it is, when you show up to their little hearings, it's a $400 fine.
Mm-hmm.
Christ almighty, and then you go in there, and what a racket that is. I mean, and then they come in, and it's like, what about Chinatown? Well, they get the vote out, They make sure everyone votes, and, we're not as organized around mm-hmm. it. So, they come in, and they have to look, if they don't find something wrong, they're not doing their job.
So the
self-perpetuating government, the fat job. I'd like to have that job.
The patronage system is alive and well.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. And I wasn't raised that way. That stuff drives me up a wall.
Mm-hmm.
To go down there and have them sit there and tell me it's $1,700 and then allow me to negotiate that to $400, it's just a scam. You go out and it's like, next,
While owning a small retail business is tough, Dugan's always looking for ways to increase business. Most recently, he started Wellfleet, where he turns the Fish Guy shop into a temporary upscale restaurant on Thursday nights. The idea came from a New York Times article on the occasional supper clubs in Paris.
Our culture, one of the few that doesn't spend the time everybody else seems to around eating or around and what's involved in eating. That is another thing that sort of drove the whole idea here. Once a week, you know, encourage people to kind of get together in a setting that might encourage some cross-pollination there, some ideas, some exchanges. More, just a more relaxed setting. But I think the public's ready for some different stuff, and I think they're looking for places that serve it. I'll tell you, they'll find it at Wellfleet. I am going to always be serving. I can promise this. I will never repeat an item. I might do something similar or similarly inspired, but it'll never be the same. I think that's just boring to me. Mm-hmm. What I want to do is serve high-end ingredients simply. Like that caviar. There was an ounce of caviar there. And I purposely am doing things that have disappointed me in the past. Where you go to wherever, and they're serving caviar as a component to the dish. There's not even enough there to taste, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, an ounce is a lot of caviar, and it gives you a hell of a good taste of that stuff. So you can eat it. You can taste what it tastes like, mm-hmm. you know? It's not served with egg and chopped red onion. That's why I purposely thought, you know, it's expensive to eat out. I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just trying to simplify the thing in that there aren't taxes. You don't have to think about tipping. They're really getting weighted on. I mean, I'm not making any money right now. Mm-hmm. Trying to figure it out, and I think there's a way to do it, but that's not my concern. I'm not crunching the numbers on the food costs, and you know, I think one night we pre-prepared, you know, to get 12 lobsters that I thought were perfect enough. We went through 18 of them. The other ones were nothing was wrong with them really, but I said just we'll use them in the bisque or something. You know, I didn't like the way there wasn't enough meat inside them. So we really are trying a lot of things. You know, I think we're going to a great deal of trouble to make sure that we're doing the best, we're putting out the best product we can for these 12 people.
Dugan's commitment to detail and quality at Wellfleet comes from working with some of Chicago's best chefs over the years.
Trotter, that guy's world famous, you know. You go into his place, he's there, not a whole lot has changed, and I'll tell you, it's very inspirational to me when I go in there, because there's so much pride, just the service is done so eloquently, the food is always great, so it just all comes through, and you know, and I mean, that, you know, and that guy has written books, I mean, where does he get the time,
yeah.
Where does he get the energy, you know, I gotta tell you, I admire him greatly, you know. You hear other people talk about him, he's, you know, the devil incarnate. But, I mean, you know, the thing is I admire his passion for what he does. I mean, I don't take it to that level. Mm-hmm. But I aspire to that. I try, you know, and I try to get my staff to think that way, too. That
with Dugan aspiring to work at a high level, I asked him, as I did Dirk Fusick, who would win in a steel cage match between the two fishmongers?
I gotta say this. I've never met him.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a couple of people over the years who I hired and then learned that they worked for him. They never had an unkind thing to say about him, you know. So I mean, that says a lot to me. I heard he's a nice guy. I've never met him. I went to his store once. I thought the glaring difference is he has a lot of things for sale in there that he does, that, you know, just condiments and stuff. My feeling was, and this is just my personal choice, that unless we make it here, I don't want to sell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want my staff to concentrate on talking about fish.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind them talking up a soup they made, you know. I want them to feel good about what they're selling because they made it, you know?
And I couldn't go without asking the fish guy one of my favorite questions. If he was on death row and he knew it was his last meal, what would he eat?
Boy, desert island food.
That's right.
Would you like me to answer that in the vernacular fish? It would be peanut butter. I love peanut butter, probably. I think probably some really beautiful sashimi. Just something, a little soy sauce.
Any particular fish?
Yeah, I like tunas and jacks. But I like it. You know, when you get something that's just so fresh, I like. My favorite raw combination is fluke or flounder, what they call hirami, with a little shiso leaf wrapped around it. God, I just love that. I like that soy cut with water, and I like steamed fish with it over that, steamed shrimp, just a little bit of that, you know. But I would say, yeah, sort of, just some really nice boss tuna or something. Just, yeah, some really nice big-eyed tuna or something. Yeah.
Cool.
I like that.
Well, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, my pleasure. God, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed these interviews. As always, if you have feedback, please drop me a line at mjnagran@hungrymag.com. And in the meantime, stay hungry. One more time.